asked God to defend him, to save him from beauty. Because he says, there is too much beauty in the world. It came from the fields, from the sea, from rivers, from night.
Is Democracy Now.
I'm very proud of the job that this group of young people, generally young people, but very smart people, they're doing. They're doing it at my insistence. It would be a lot easier not to do it, but we have to take some of these things apart to find the corruption. We found tremendous corruption.
Legal experts are warning of a constitutional crisis as the Trump administration hints it may ignore a federal judge's ruling, temporarily blocking Elon Musk and his Doge associates from accessing the Treasury Department's payment systems and American sensitive data. Over the weekend, Musk called for the judge to be impeached. Vice President Vance questioned the judge's authority. We'll look at Doge's young so-called engineers who are playing a key role in Musk's overhaul of federal agencies. We'll speak with Wired reporter Victoria Elliott, who's broken major stories on Musk and the young men who comprise his Doge army. Meanwhile, the South African-born billionaire Elon Musk is claiming white South Africans have been victims of racist ownership laws and accused the post-apartheid government of anti-white racism, pushing the Trump administration to cut off all aid Friday until further notice to South Africa. This comes after Musk's father helped arrange a call with the South African president to oppose the land reform law.
I can only imagine that Elon would have said, look, we want to help you, but you have to quit this war on white people in South Africa.
We'll go to South Africa and then to the occupied West Bank as Israel intensifies its military assault, which has displaced 35,000 Palestinians, and Trump doubles down on his plans for Gaza.
I'm committed to buying and owning Gaza.
We'll speak with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti in Ramallah. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's giving hints it may ignore a federal judge's ruling restricting Elon Musk and his associates in Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency, from accessing the Treasury Department's critical payment systems. In his decision, U.S. District Judge Paul Engelmeyer warned about the, quote, disclosure of sensitive and confidential information and the heightened risk that the systems in question will be more vulnerable than before to hacking, unquote. Vice President J.D. Vance responded to the ruling by writing on social media, quote, judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power, unquote. Elon Musk also called for the judge to be impeached. On Sunday, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy appeared on ABC This Week and warned against what he called the billionaire takeover of the government.
And I think this is the most serious constitutional crisis the country has faced, certainly since Watergate. The president is attempting to seize control of power and for corrupt purposes. The president wants to be able to decide how and where money is spent so that he can reward his political friends, he can punish his political enemies. That is the evisceration of democracy.
In other news about Doge, Elon Musk says he's rehiring 25-year-old Marco Ellis, who resigned after being linked to a deleted social media account that advocated racism and eugenics, among other things, writing, normalize Indian hate. Trump and J.D. Vance had both called for him to be rehired. Donald Trump has repeated his proposal for the United States to take ownership of Gaza, describing Gaza as a, quote, big real estate site. Trump said it would be a, quote, big mistake to let Palestinians stay there. This comes as the State Department's announced a new $7 billion arms sale to Israel, including thousands of bombs and missiles. On Saturday, Israel and Hamas conducted another swap of captives. Hamas released three Israeli men who'd been held hostage since October 7, 2023. Israeli health officials said the freed men were suffering from severe malnutrition. Israel released 183 Palestinians, including at least seven who needed immediate hospital care. This is Ala Alaga, one of the Palestinians released Saturday.
The conditions were very bad. No food, no water, no medicine. We were in a torture center for 24 hours. I spent 40 days handcuffed and blindfolded, and I could not go to the bathroom or anywhere else. There was no food. I entered prison at 100 kilograms and left at 58 kilograms.
In other news from Gaza, Israeli forces have withdrawn from the Netzarim corridor, the key strip of land that bisects Gaza. Meanwhile, a new investigation by 972 magazine and Local Call reveals Israeli forces indiscriminately drop bunker buster bombs on residential buildings in Gaza in an attempt to flood underground tunnels with lethal fumes in order to suffocate Hamas fighters. But 972 reports dozens of these Israeli airstrikes likely endangered or killed hostages as well. In the occupied West Bank, Israel's intensifying its military assault, which has already displaced 35,000 Palestinians. On Saturday, Israeli troops raided the Nur Shams refugee camp, where they killed two women, including one 23-year-old, Sunduz Jamal Jalabi, who was 8 months pregnant. Her husband was critically injured. Palestinian officials said efforts to save her baby failed in part because the Israeli military prevented the couple from being transferred to the hospital. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, an Israeli airstrike killed six people Saturday in the eastern Bekaa region in the latest Israeli violation of the November ceasefire. On Friday, a Trump-appointed judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration's plan to dismantle USAID and lay off thousands of workers. The judge's ruling came hours after government workers took down USAID signage from the agency's headquarters. Internal documents suggest the Trump administration's planning to cut the size of USAID staff from about 10,000 to under 300. Global aid organizations are warning the dismantling of the aid agency could impact millions of the world's most vulnerable people. The United Nations AIDS Agency warned Friday that more than 6 million people could die from HIV and AIDS over the next 4 years if PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, is not reauthorized.
As UNAIDS, we estimate that if PEPFAR wasn't reauthorized between 2025 and 2029 and other resources were not found for the HIV response, there would be a 400% increase in AIDS death. That's 6.3 million people, 6.3 million AIDS-related deaths that will occur in future.
PEPFAR was founded by former President George W. Bush. The National Institutes of Health has announced plans to slash about $4 billion in funding for biomedical research, a move that could have an immediate impact on research at universities, medical schools, and research hospitals. The AAMC, the Association of American Medical Colleges, criticized NIH's decision, saying it will, quote, diminish the nation's research capacity, slowing scientific progress, and depriving patients, families, and communities across the country of new treatments, diagnostics, and preventative interventions, unquote. Cutting NIH funding was a part of the Project 2025 playbook. The Trump administration's effectively shut down the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The Bureau's acting director, Russell Vogt, who was the architect of Project 2025, has closed the Bureau's office for the next week and has ordered staff to halt nearly all work. Vogt's move came after Elon Musk wrote a message Friday on X that said, CFPB RIP, along with an emoji of a tombstone. Since its formation in 2011, the Bureau has helped return about $21 billion to consumers. But the agency's long been criticized by Republicans and big business interests. In other economic news, Trump's announced he will soon impose 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports. Meanwhile, retaliatory Chinese tariffs on a number of U.S. products have taken effect today as a global trade war heats up. A federal judge in New Mexico has temporarily blocked the U.S. government from sending three Venezuelan men in immigration detention to Guantanamo. The Center for Constitutional Rights had sought an emergency order to protect the three men over the weekend. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem visited the U.S. Navy base in Cuba days after the first detained immigrants were flown there. In other immigration news, NBC is reporting the Trump administration is moving forward with restarting the detention of migrant families, including those with young children. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is reportedly preparing to seek bids from private prison companies to run the facilities. President Trump's ordered a freeze on foreign aid to South Africa, claiming South Africa's white population is facing unjust racial discrimination. Trump's repeatedly criticized a new land reform law in South Africa, where the country's white minority still owns the vast majority of farmland 30 years after the end of apartheid rule. We'll have more on this story later, and the headlines will go to South Africa. In Tanzania, leaders of Eastern and Southern African regional blocs called for an immediate and unconditional ceasefire in Eastern Congo as they met this weekend for an unprecedented joint summit. This is Veronica Nduva, Secretary General of the East African Community.
The joint summit directed resumption of direct negotiations and dialogue with all state and non-state parties, military and non-military, including the M23.
Also in attendance was Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who's come under mounting pressure over the presence of Rwandan troops in eastern Congo and Rwanda's backing of the M23 fighters, though Kagame continues to deny any involvement. The UN says some 3,000 people were killed in just 1 week of fighting after the M23 fighters seized the key city of Goma in late January. Over 500,000 people have been displaced in eastern Congo in recent weeks, compounding an already severe humanitarian crisis. There have been widespread reports of sexual violence. Sam Nujoma, freedom fighter turned president who led Namibia to independence from apartheid South Africa in 1990, has died at the age of 95. Often referred to as Namibia's founding father, Nujoma was known for his motto, "A united people striving to achieve a common good for all members of the society will always emerge victorious." Ecuador's presidential election will be decided in a runoff April 13th after conservative incumbent President Daniel Noboa and leftist lawyer Luis Gonzalez beat out 14 other candidates, both of them receiving over 44% of the vote. Noboa and Gonzalez previously faced off in a 2023 snap election. Both candidates vowed to crack down on crime. Last year, President Noboa, son of an ultra-rich banana magnate, declared a state of internal armed conflict to more easily deploy the military. Luis Gonzalez, a protege of former President Rafael Correa, has promised to increase social spending. She called for Ecuadorians to unite to defeat Noboa in the second round.
Meses atrás.
Months ago, we called for unity among the parties of the left and the center. We also called on the industry to join us, as well as civil society. I've also called on the parties of the right and all those who want to recover the country to make Ecuador the safest country in Latin America.
In Madrid, leaders of Europe's extreme right parties gathered Saturday at an event organized by Spain's Vox party called Make Europe Great Again. Attendees railed against immigration and hailed Trump's return to office. Speakers included Italy's Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini, French National Rally Party leader Marine Le Pen, and Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban.
The Trump tornado has changed the world in just a few weeks, and the era has ended. Yesterday, we were their heretics. Today, we are the mainstream.
Meanwhile, in Germany, at least 200,000 protesters rallied in Munich Saturday against the far-right anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany party, known as AfD, which is polling in second place 2 weeks ahead of national elections. Back in Washington, D.C., President Trump has moved to take over the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. On Friday, Trump fired numerous board members and said he would become the new chair of the Kennedy Center. Meanwhile, the National Endowment for the Arts has shut down a grant program aimed at underserved groups and communities. The NEA under Trump says it is looking to fund more projects celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States. On Sunday night, one of the Kennedy board members who was just fired, the acclaimed musician John Batiste, sang the Star-Spangled Banner at the start of the Super Bowl with President Trump in attendance. Ahead of the game, the NFL removed the words "end racism" from the end zones. During Kendrick Lamar's halftime performance, one of the dancers unveiled a Sudanese flag and Palestinian flag sewn together. The performer managed to run around the field holding the flag for about 20 seconds. Security guards then tackled the performer, who was arrested. Meanwhile, the state of Louisiana is facing criticism for efforts to remove unhoused people from the streets of New Orleans before the Super Bowl. The Guardian reports the state spent $17.5 million to coerce more than 100 unhoused people to be bused to a remote, unheated warehouse that lacked enough blankets and cots. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Legal experts are warning of a constitutional crisis. As the Trump administration hints it may ignore a federal judge's ruling temporarily blocking Elon Musk and his Doge associates from accessing the Treasury Department's payment systems and sensitive data. Over the weekend, Elon Musk lashed out at Judge Paul Engelmeyer, referring to him on X as a, quote, corrupt judge protecting corruption, calling for Engelmeyer to be impeached. In his ruling, Engelmeyer warned of irreparable harm presented by Doge's access to sensitive information and of the, quote, heightened risk that the systems in question will be more vulnerable than before to hacking, unquote. In response, Vice President J.D. Vance said on X, quote, if a judge tried to tell a general how to conduct a military operation, that would be illegal. If a judge tried to command the attorney general on how to use her discretion as a prosecutor, that's also illegal. Judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power, said the vice president of the United States, a graduate of Yale Law School, J.D. Vance. Meanwhile, President Trump on Friday said nearly every federal agency in the U.S. government could fall under the scrutiny of Doge. Trump was questioned by Fox News White House correspondent Peter Ducey.
And we're going to be doing more and more of that. We're going to be looking at Department of Education. We're going to be looking at even our military. We're going to be looking at tremendous amounts of money, Peter, being spent on things that bear no relationship to anything and have no value. We're talking about trillions of dollars. It will be, in the end, trillions of dollars being absolutely wasted and perhaps illegally.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy appeared on ABC this week Sunday and warned against what he called the billionaire takeover of government.
And I think this is the most serious constitutional crisis the country has faced, certainly since Watergate. The president is attempting to seize control of power and for corrupt purposes. The president wants to be able to decide how and where money is spent so that he can reward his political friends, he can punish his political enemies. That is the evisceration of democracy.
This all comes as more details have emerged of Doge's young so-called engineers who are playing a key role in Musk's overhaul of federal agencies, including Edward Korstein. He's 19 years old, a college dropout. He graduated from Rye Country Day High School last June. Other Doge engineers have been identified as 21-year-old Akash Baba, who has been listed as an expert at the Office of Personnel Management and reportedly has been able to access internal databases, 23-year-old Luke Farator, a former intern at Musk SpaceX, 24-year-old Gauthier Cole Killian, 25-year-old Gavin Klieger, who described Trump's failed U.S. Attorney General nominee and accused sexual abuser Matt Gaetz as a victim of the deep state, and 22-year-old Ethan Shout. Musk said on Friday he would be rehiring 25-year-old Doge staff member Marco Elles, who resigned last week after he was linked to a deleted social media account that advocated racism and eugenics, writing, among other things, "normalize Indian hate." Both Trump and J.D. Vance called for Elles to be rehired. For more, we're joined here in New York by Victoria Elliott, reporter for Wired, covering platforms and power. She and her team have broken several major stories on Elon Musk and Doge. Elliott's recent piece has headlined the recruitment effort that helped build Elon Musk's Doge army. Welcome back to Democracy Now, or to Democracy Now for the first time. Thank you for joining us. We know you are under the weather, tired for so much reporting on this fire hose of presidential actions. Victoria, what do you think is most important for us to understand of this Doge army? You can refer to them by their names or by their various handles, which are quite amazing.
I mean, I think the most important thing is to note that, you know, what we're really seeing is people coming out of either Musk's companies or companies owned by Peter Thiel, another billionaire who's very close to Musk. He's the chair of Palantir, a big data analytics company that is also a massive defense contractor. And so what I think was really interesting for us when we reported that most recent story is the fact that, you know, these young people were sourcing within these already established networks of people who are very, very technically gifted, probably because they've worked at these companies, but that this is sort of a closed network. And what we've sort of learned being tech reporters in general is that oftentimes people in the tech industry see the press as pretty adversarial. They see government in some ways as sometimes pretty adversarial with overreach and red tape. And so I think what stuck out to me is that although Musk sort of put out this public call on X, it seems that a lot of the people who are part of this effort were people drawn from what he and people who are close to him would consider trusted networks. And in that way, you know, I think this sort of sense that Doge is almost this parallel operation to sort of traditional government operations really feels very salient, particularly when these people have access to really sensitive data that people who are government contractors maybe would not often have, or people who are new hires into government would not often have.
So talk more about who the young people are, like the Rye Country Day graduate from last year. His name, Edward Carstein, he's referred to, he refers to himself as Big Balls. These are the people that the administration is referring to as these efficiency experts. He's the one. Senators aren't allowed now into the Treasury Department to see what's going on. They're stopped by police. But he's right there.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think a lot of these people, you know, if you look at their backgrounds, they're people with really strong technical skills. You know, I think they all have, you know, really some impressive achievements on their resumes. I think Edward Carstein, as you mentioned, is quite young. And our team was able to sort of identify that he was seemed to be associated with a possible DDoS, or distributed denial of service for hire situation. So, you know, that particularly is sketchy. And I think when we're looking at that, even if these people are particularly technically gifted, they may not.
Can you explain what that means for people who are not digitally completely literate?
Sure. So a DDoS thing it is a sort of distributed denial of service. It's a form of attack. So it's when someone comes to your website is flooded with views at such a high rate that it basically shuts your whole website down. It's sort of meant to overwhelm a technical system. And it's a form of cyber attack. And so I think it's one of those things where when we look at that type of instance, you know, even if these young men are very technically gifted, and they very well may be, you know, they do seem to have questionable, some of them seem to have questionable backgrounds. And if they were going through the regular process of, you know, doing a security clearance or getting background checked for a government job to access the kind of sensitive data that they would seem to be having access to right now, they may not have actually been given that if they were adhering to the standard protocol that we have set up within the U.S. government for reasons to be able to vet people's background, to be able to ensure that people who are touching this data or can manipulate this data are trustworthy, have been sort of vetted. And again, as I've said sort of multiple times, even if these are incredibly technically gifted people who have nothing but the purest of intentions, they've only had access to these systems at best since January 20th. And anyone who started a new job anywhere at any time could tell you that is not enough time to be getting into a system and making substantial changes to
and
it.
And I mean, someone like Marco Ellis, who was the focus this weekend because he was fired when it came out, that now deleted social media account that advocated repealing the Civil Rights Act back to eugenic immigration policy and, quote, said, just for the record, I was racist before it was cool. And he's the one who advocated normalizing Indian hate. The front person advocating for him to be rehired, which he was Vice President J.D. Vance, whose wife, of course, Usha Vance, is Indian American. His three children, Indian American. Victoria.
Yeah, I think that's a distraction. The reality is, I think obviously his views would probably, again, if he had been properly background checked, would have come up, would have been something that, might have been flagged in the regular process. And, if he was applying for a regular government job, he might not have been hired. But I think the more critical issue is the fact that whether or not it's Marco Ellis or someone else on the DOGE team, it does seem that this, parallel entity that is DOGE is accessing sensitive data that otherwise would not be available to it. At least from our reporting, we saw that, or it appeared that Marco did at some point have read-write access to the code. And I think this is incredibly important because we've already seen the way that the DOGE effort and the Trump administration has tried to get around paying out funds that have been allocated by Congress for, agencies, for programs that have also been approved by Congress. I think that is the most concerning thing.
In a piece that was headlined, a U.S. Treasury threat intelligence analysis designates DOGE staff as insider threat. Talk about the significance of that, Victoria.
I think it's important just because it acknowledges that at least in some capacity, the experts that the Treasury was working with acknowledged that having people in these systems who were not vetted, who had the ability to apparently read and write code and sort of be within these systems without much oversight, without much training, is an incredible risk.
And we're going to talk in a moment about the what's been called the PayPal mafia. But I'd like you to go into Elon Musk. You've written about him extensively as an international far right leader. Talk about his ties to the far right in Germany, where there was just a mass protest, and how he's used his digital platform.
I mean, he has platformed the leader of the AfD party in Germany in the same way he did with Trump, which is he sort of had an X spaces with her. He has come out very publicly in support of the AfD, the other weekend, and I apologize, I can't remember the day because they're all blurring together. He posted Make Europe Great Again. It's very clear that his ambitions for reshaping politics don't end at U.S. borders. And I think, even before the U.S. elections, we saw a taste of that with how he behaved in Brazil. The Brazilian courts required him to, or required X to take down accounts that they said were associated with their attempted overthrow of a free and fair election. And X refused to do it until the Brazilian government banned the platform. But that resistance that X showed to try and keep up these right-wing accounts and to share the otherwise secret court orders with Congressman Jim Jordan, whose committee then made them public. You know, at the time, many Brazilian scholars and legal experts sort of said that they felt that X's and Musk's behavior was essentially trying to assault their democratic institutions and disobey their duly elected government. And so I think, you know, we've seen tastes of this even before Musk was part of the Trump administration. And I think that, you know, Musk is a global businessman. His interests extend far beyond the U.S. borders. And I think, therefore, his political interests extend beyond the U.S. borders as well.
Let me finally ask you about the difficulty of the challenges of reporting in this time. You have the interim U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Edward R. Martin, threatening to go after people who identify or criticize individuals. Wired is breaking story after story. You are naming names, Vittoria. Are you concerned?
We're just continuing to do the work.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Vittoria Elliott, reporter for Wired. One other question. Are they downloading this information? Do we know what they're doing inside these agencies, these 19, 20-year-old kids, kids who call themselves big balls, kids who talk about normalizing Indian hate? Are they downloading the private health and financial information of millions of people in this country?
We don't know, and the lack of transparency is what's concerning. My colleagues have also reported that, you know, my colleagues, McKenna Kelly also reported, you know, that it does seem that they want to lean more, that DOGE as a sort of mission wants to lean more heavily into AI and automating systems. And, you know, it would follow, although we don't know, that kind of data would be needed to train an automated system. But again, we don't know. And that is, you know, a big part of the issue is just the lack of transparency.
Vittoria Elliott, we thank you so much for being with us. Reporter for Wired, she and her team have broken a number of major stories on Elon Musk and DOGE. We'll link to them. Vittoria's recent headline, the recruitment effort that helped build Elon Musk's DOGE army. Next up, in addition to heading DOGE, the South African-born richest man in the world, Elon Musk, is claiming white South Africans have been the victims of racist ownership laws. New U.S. government, Trump administration, has just announced they're cutting off all aid to South Africa. Stay with us.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight? Lights last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, was so gallantly streaming.
The musical legend John Batiste singing the Star Spangled Banner at the start of the Super Bowl Sunday night. His performance came just days after President Trump fired him and others from serving on the board of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In the audience at the Super Bowl was President Trump, the first president to attend a Super Bowl. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump ordered a freeze on all foreign aid to South Africa in an executive order Friday, claiming South Africa's white populations facing, quote, government-sponsored race-based discrimination. Trump has repeatedly criticized the new land reform law in South Africa, where the country's white minority still owns the vast majority of farmland 30 years after the end of apartheid rule. Trump wrote on his Truth Social account Sunday, South Africa's confiscating land and treating certain classes of people very badly, unquote. Trump has made the claim before. The South African government says it's part of a, quote, campaign of misinformation and propaganda, unquote. His order also claims South African leaders have, quote, taken aggressive positions toward the U.S. and its allies, citing its pursuit of genocide claims against Israel before the International Court of Justice. South Africans responded to the freeze of an estimated $440 million in U.S. aid. This is a woman seeking her regular treatment for HIV/AIDS when she realized the clinic was closed. She spoke with Sky News Africa correspondent Yusra Albari.
Are you trying to go to the clinic?
Yeah.
It's closed.
What happened?
I mean, the U.S. aid funding has been frozen, so they're closing down clinics. Do you have alternatives?
I don't know. I'm going to ask next door. Hopefully, they'll be able to assist me. If they can't, I don't know. I don't know what to do. Serious. What will I do? There's nothing.
Trump's order also offered refugee status in the United States to white South Africans, Afrikaners, who are, quote, victims of unjust racial discrimination. But many in the right-wing white lobby groups say they want to stay and focus on ending black majority rule. All of this comes as the South African-born billionaire, the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, now a leader in Trump's administration, has said white South Africans have been the victims of, quote, racist ownership laws and accused the post-apartheid government of anti-white racism. Last week, Musk's 78-year-old father, Errol Musk, said an advisor to South African President Cyril Ramaphosa asked him to help.
I was asked if I can arrange a quick talk between Ramaphosa and Elon last night. So I said, all right, so I did. And then they spoke a few minutes later, and it's on my phone. I can only imagine that Elon would have said, look, we want to help you, but you have to quit this war on white people in South Africa.
Errol Musk is Elon Musk's father. Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, has increasingly embraced far-right leaders and conspiracy theaters, the sum of linked to his roots in apartheid-era South Africa. In a minute, we'll also look at how Musk is part of the PayPal mafia of libertarian billionaires with roots in South Africa under white rule, who now hold powerful positions in the tech industry and politics and surround the White House. But we begin in Johannesburg with Trevor Ngwane, Soweto-based activist and chair of the United Front, umbrella body of community and labor organizations. Welcome back, Trevor, to Democracy Now! Talk about the effects of this immediate cutting off of all U.S. aid to South Africa, your country.
Thank you, Emmy. Yeah, it's terrible because remember that there's a lot of programs here which rely on American funding, primarily the HIV program, PEPFAR. 17% of the programs are funded by money from America. And with one stroke, all that those services were stopped because no money came through and millions of people are suffering, including other community, social and health programs. So this is very bad for the people here in South Africa.
I mean, it's very interesting you mentioned PEPFAR. Let's remember that it was established by the former Republican president of the United States, George W. Bush, what many call perhaps the most important achievement of his presidency. The significance when you talk, Trevor, looking back at the end of apartheid in 94, white South Africans who make up, what, 7% of the population, owning farms that make up about half of South Africa. What are your thoughts on the information or misinformation we're getting in the United States about land seizures from Donald Trump and from the South African-born Elon Musk?
Well, white people, you know, are sitting pretty. They managed to hang on to most of their wealth due to global and local economic processes. The rich continue to get richer and the poor get poorer. Most of the white, of the farmland, more than 70% of it is owned by white farmers. So basically, they're sitting pretty. You know, they've got nothing to complain about. Perhaps, Amy, you know, there's a saying, the guilty are afraid. Perhaps they know that this unjust situation where a tiny minority enjoys, you know, most of the country's wealth and resources is not tenable. And sooner or later, it will have to end.
And finally, Trevor, President Trump welcoming Afrikaner refugees into the United States as flight after flight takes immigrants from the United States, for example, to Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the white people here are not interested in going to the USA because they're having a good life here. The only thing that is bothering them is what I can call white fears in the face of black aspirations. Indeed, black frustrations, because after 30 years of democracy, not much has changed in terms of, you know, wealth ownership, in terms of basic improvement in the everyday lives of the people. White people, they are human beings. They can see that the suffering continues. They're just guilty. And they know that they should part, give away some of their wealth, but they are not prepared. So they are using politics, ideology, misinformation, and propaganda, some of them, you know, to maintain the status quo.
Trevor Ngwane is joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa. I want to bring into this conversation Chris McGreal. He was the Johannesburg correspondent for The Guardian during the last years of apartheid until 2002. His new piece for The Guardian is titled, What Does Elon Musk Believe? And How the Roots of the PayPal Mafia Extend to Apartheid South Africa. This is really illuminating, Chris. Who are the PayPal Mafia, and how are they linked to apartheid-era South Africa?
Well, they're a group of men who are at the top, the founding of PayPal, all of whom, in some way or other, grew up in South Africa as children. You've got Musk himself, who was born in South Africa and lived there, went to high school there until he was 18 and then moves to Canada. You've got Peter Thiel, who was a co-founder with Musk of PayPal. Thiel was born in Germany but brought to South Africa as a young child. His father was a mining engineer. Lived in Johannesburg and then moved to Southwest Africa, which was then a South African colony, is now Namibia. And he went to school in Swakopmund, which was notorious as probably the last place on the planet where people still openly greeted each other with Heil Hitler and celebrated Hitler's birthday. He went to a German school there before moving to the United States when he was 10 or 11. You've got David Sacks, who was born in Cape Town. He's big in PayPal and is now Trump's AI and crypto czar. He moved to Tennessee as a relatively young child, but grew up in the white South African diaspora there. And you've got Rolf Botha, who was the son of Pik Botha, the grandson of Pik Botha, the last foreign minister of apartheid South Africa. He was the acceptable face of apartheid. You'll remember he used to run around the United States trying to put a gloss on how they were reforming things and that everything was getting better, which apparently it wasn't. But so you see those four key people at the top of PayPal, and they all have this, you know, very intimate connection to South Africa.
So we just played Errol Musk. That's Elon Musk's father. Talk about what the significance of what he said and also how he gained his wealth in South Africa and when these men left South Africa.
So, well, Errol Musk still lives in South Africa,
yeah,
which is why, of course,
kids.
Errol Musk made his money in lots of different ways, but the main way was he had investments in emerald mines in Zambia, and he became extremely wealthy. Now, conditions on those mines were notoriously bad, as they were on mines throughout sort of southern Central Africa. He made a lot of money from that, so much so that when Musk's mother divorces him, There's listed a jet, a yacht, several houses in the divorce settlement. So he was extremely, extremely rich. Musk himself, he stayed in South Africa till he was 18. He goes to school first in Johannesburg and ends up at Pretoria Boys High, which is a largely racially exclusive white all white school near Pretoria, which is the capital. There was a quirk of it in which there were some black students. I think the first black student in the school was the son of a foreign diplomat, but the diplomat came from one of the black homelands that only South Africa recognized as independent, part of the apartheid structures. Musk has a Canadian passport through his mother, because Musk's mother's father was, mother's parents were Canadian. And there's a whole story there. I mean, Errol Musk regarded himself as an anti-apartheid liberal. He joined the Progressive Federal Party, which was ostensibly against apartheid, but he leaves it when it starts supporting one person, one vote. He actually doesn't believe in that. Musk's grandfather, Canadian grandfather, had been the head of the Canadian branch of a political movement in the 1930s called Technocracy Incorporated, which in essence wanted to scrap democracy in the United States and Canada and have technocrats rule the country, which might sound familiar. That becomes a de facto fascist party, is banned during the Second World War, and then the grandfather moves to apartheid South Africa, having had no connection to the place, in 1950 because he likes the sound of apartheid. And even Errol Musk says of the grandfather, he was an open neo-Nazi.
This is Errol Musk's father, Errol, on Podcast and Chill with Mac G, discussing Elon Musk's mother's father, Joshua Haldeman, alleging he supported Nazis and South Africa's apartheid.
Her parents, by the way, were very fanatical in favor of apartheid. This is quite interesting. Mm. Her parents came to South Africa from Canada because they sympathized with the Afrikaner government. They used to support Hitler and all that sort of stuff. Mm-mm. But they didn't know, obviously, I don't think they knew what the Nazis were doing. But they in Canada, they were they were in the German party in Canada, and they sympathized with the Germans.
Yeah.
So when the Afrikaners government came into power here in 1948, then May's father, who was quite an interesting guy, he was a very good pilot, He said he wants to be with the Afrikaners because he agrees with apartheid.
So, again, that's Errol Musk, Elon Musk's father, as we begin to wrap up this discussion. If you can talk about what has just happened, the power of the PayPal mafia now in determining, perhaps, that the U.S. would cut off all aid to South Africa and accept Afrikaners as refugees to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty astonishing. It really is. But it's really rooted in something that goes back a few years, which is a campaign by white Afrikaner farmers through an organization called AfriForum, which were very active here during the first Trump term. They came in 2018, met John Bolton and others, and they were very much pushing the idea of a white genocide in South Africa. And really, it's a continuation of that campaign. AfriForum has been at the forefront of the idea that Afrikaners are the victims of the end of apartheid, that Afrikaners are the people who have really suffered in South Africa. And it's now come to this point where, absurdly, it's being proposed that they have refugee status.
Finally, were you surprised by Elon Musk's Nazi-like or Nazi salute when he was addressing people at a Trump rally?
Well, given that it was instantly recognized for what it was, yes. I even by Elon Musk's standards, I thought, wow. I wasn't surprised that he then tries to pretend it wasn't what it was, and he comes up with all kinds of other explanations. But I think almost everybody that watched that instantly went, oh, we know what that is, and assumed that Elon knew what it was as well.
Chris McGreal, longtime Johannesburg correspondent for The Guardian, will link to his piece, How the Roots of the PayPal Mafia Extend to Apartheid South Africa. And we'll do part two of this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Next up, as Trump doubles down on plans to own Gaza, We go to the occupied West Bank, where Israel's intensified its military assault. Back in 20 seconds. Lift Every Voice and Sing, performed by Sister Marie Knight. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in the occupied West Bank as Israel's intensifying its military assault, which has displaced 35,000 Palestinians in recent weeks. On Saturday, Israeli troops raided the Nur Shams refugee camp, where they killed two women, including one who is 8 months pregnant, her husband critically injured. Palestinian health officials said efforts to save the woman's fetus failed in part because the Israeli military prevented the couple from being transferred to the hospital. This comes as President Trump's doubled down on his proposal for the United States to own Gaza and forcibly displace Palestinians living there. For more, we go to Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, where we're joined by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician, activist, politician who serves as General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. He's been a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council since 2006. Dr. Barghouti, welcome back to Democracy Now! There's so much to discuss and so little time. If you can start off by talking about President Trump's proposal, clearly not off the cuff, as he was reading and has doubled down almost every day on saying the U.S. will own Gaza and the millions of Palestinians who live there should go elsewhere. In fact, he's talked about Jordan, he's talked about Egypt, and the Jordanian king is coming to the White House tomorrow to meet with Trump.
I think what President Trump announced is nothing but an advocacy of two major war crimes. And what he said should be described as it is, very, very clearly. He is calling for ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people of Gaza, which is an act of war. It's an act, it's a criminal, it's a war crime. And second, he's calling for theft of Gaza from its owners, from the Palestinian people who live in Gaza, who lived there for more than 4,000 years, who own the place, who have their civilization there, their houses used to be there, their whole life was there. And he wants to simply ethnically cleanse them and then take away the land from them. I wonder how would President Trump respond if somebody suggested that all people of New York should be evicted to Afghanistan, for instance, so that somebody else can take their land and create a constructive project there. Something has to be clear. Palestinians will not leave their country. Israel tried to ethnically cleanse all Palestinians during a horrible genocide, which lasted for 15 months, killing more than 70,000 Palestinians, including 17,000 children. And they failed because Palestinians stuck to their land and they are not planning to leave anywhere.
Can you talk about what you think the king, the Jordanian king, should say when he meets with Trump tomorrow, or what you understand he's going to say?
Well, as you have seen, not only Jordan, but Egypt as well, and Saudi Arabia, and all Arab countries were very angry at what Trump said. And Egypt and Jordan made it very clear that there is that they will not cooperate in this crime of ethnic cleansing against the Palestinian people. I think the Jordanian king will tell President Trump several things. First of all, that his people, the people of Jordan, will never accept that the regime would cooperate in any act of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. Second, that a new transfer of Palestinians to Jordan will simply the end of will simply mean the end of Jordan as a Hashemite kingdom.
This will mean the end of the place completely. And it would fulfill what Netanyahu and his crowd, his fascist crowd, are calling for, which is let Jordan be the Palestinian state and simply evict all Palestinians, not only from Gaza, but also from the West Bank. And thirdly, I think President Trump will try to pressure the king by threatening to cut down the foreign aid to Jordan and maybe use other methods of pressure. But the king has leverage here, which will be the summit of the Arab countries. And we've been calling on all Arab countries to do three things. First of all, to issue a very clear position rejecting Trump's plan of conducting a new war crime against the Palestinian people. Second, that they should establish some sort of a safety net for both Jordan and Egypt if they are subjected to manipulations from Trump, from President Trump. And third, that all Arab countries must provide every support they can to Palestinians to help their steadfastness, not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, since the Israeli army is already conducting ethnic cleansing of Jenin refugee camp, of Tul Karim refugee camp, of Nur Shams refugee camp, and practically it has moved the war from Gaza to the West Bank.
So talk about what's happening right now in the West Bank. Just in the last few weeks, we're talking about tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians. I'm not talking about Gaza, right? We're talking about the West Bank. Explain more about what's happening in Nur Shams and Jenin. Talk about the 8-month-old pregnant woman who was killed by the Israeli military.
What the Israelis are doing in the West Bank is nothing but another war crime. They've already, in addition to arresting 12,500 people since October 7th, during the last month, January alone, the Israeli army arrested 580 more Palestinians, many of whom will be put under administrative detention because they cannot charge them with anything. And most importantly, the Israeli army initiated a military operation in the north of the West Bank, which has affected up till now 4 major refugee camps. In Jenin camp, they've already destroyed more than 150 homes and houses, and they are now, and they've evicted 20,000 people who are the whole inhabitants of the refugee camp. They evicted them out of the camp, conducting an act of ethnic cleansing. 80% of the people in Tul Karim refugee camp have also been evicted, the same in Nur Shams refugee camp. And now there is a huge attack since 9 days on Al Far'a refugee camp in Tubas area. So we are talking here about a terrible military campaign with destruction of infrastructure, destruction of houses. Footage that comes out of Jenin actually shows us something very similar to the destruction and damage that was caused in many parts of Gaza. But more than that, more than 80 people have been killed since the initiation of this operation. About 1/3 of them are children and women. And the last woman who was killed was 8 months pregnant. She was 8 months pregnant. She tried with her husband and 2 of their children to get out of the camp, to get medical, to go to a clinic, to get medical consultation, because she was worried about her pregnancy. And when they were trying to leave the camp, the Israeli soldiers saw them and shot them. The father was critically injured. The mother was very seriously injured. An ambulance managed to get to them, transported them. When they were in front of the main governmental hospital, the Israeli army stopped the ambulance for 30 minutes, and that woman bled to death, and her child died too because of her bleeding. And the most horrifying thing is that the 2 other children watched the horror of the death of their mother and the injury of their father. This is the kind of what the Israeli, the kind of thing that the Israeli army is doing, not only in Jenin and in Tul Karim refugee camps, but also in Jenin and in other places. But the whole West Bank, Amy, is now under attack because Israel has imposed on this little area no less than 920 military checkpoints and gates What does a gate mean? It means that the army comes into a village or a town and put a gate in front of the main road to that place. They shut off all other roads, and then they close the gate and leave, which means these villages become prisons, small prisons where everybody is stuck, cannot go to their work, cannot go to for medical care if they need it, cannot go for their education in schools or universities. This is the kind of life we live in. And now transportation in the West Bank is totally obstructed because a trip that usually takes 40 minutes could take 5 hours. Sometimes it is totally impossible. On Saturdays, almost the whole West Bank is shut off. So It's a real situation of war, and everything is affected. Trade is affected, economy is affected, medical care is affected. We are unable to reach many people who need our health care.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti is a medical doctor as well as an activist and a politician who serves as general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. We thank you so much for being with us from Israeli-occupied West Bank, from Ramallah.